It makes sense, then, that Westerners value boldness and verbal skill, traits that promote individuality, while Asians prize quiet, humility, and sensitivity, which foster group cohesion. If you live in a collective, then things will go a lot more smoothly if you behave with restraint, even submission. This preference was vividly demonstrated in a recent fMRI study in which researchers showed 17 Americans and 17 Japanese pictures of men in dominance poses, arms crossed, muscles bulging, legs planted squarely on the ground, and subordinate positions, shoulders bent, hands interlocked protectively over groin, legs squeezed together tight. They found that the dominant pictures activated pleasure centers in the American brains, while the submissive pictures did the same for the Japanese. From a Western perspective, it can be hard to see what's so attractive about submitting to the will of others. But what looks to a Westerner like subordination can seem like basic politeness to many Asians. Don Chen, the Chinese-American Harvard Business School student you met in Chapter 2, told me about the time he shared an apartment with a group of Asian friends, plus his close Caucasian friend, a gentle, easygoing guy Don felt would fit right in. Conflicts arose when the Caucasian friend noticed dishes piling up in the sink and asked his Asian roommates to do their fair share of the washing up. It wasn't an unreasonable complaint, says Don, and his friend thought he phrased his request politely and respectfully. But his Asian roommates saw it differently. To them, he came across as harsh and angry. An Asian in that situation, said Don, would be more careful with his tone of voice. He would phrase his displeasure in the form of a question, not a request or command. Or he might not bring it up at all. It wouldn't be worth upsetting the group over a few dirty dishes. What looks to Westerners like Asian deference, in other words, is actually a deeply felt concern for the sensibilities of others. As the psychologist Harris Bond observes, it is only those from an explicit tradition who would label the Asian mode of discourse self-effacement. Within this indirect tradition, it might be labeled relationship honoring. And relationship honoring leads to social dynamics that can seem remarkable from a Western perspective. It's because of relationship honoring, for example, that social anxiety disorder in Japan, known as Taijin Kyofusho, takes the form not of excessive worry about embarrassing oneself, as it does in the United States, but of embarrassing others. It's because of relationship honoring that Tibetan Buddhist monks find inner peace and off-the-chart happiness levels as measured in brain scans by meditating quietly on compassion. And it's because of relationship honoring that Hiroshima victims apologize to each other for surviving. Their civility has been well documented, but still stays the heart, writes the essayist Lydia Millett. I am sorry, said one of them, bowing, with the skin of his arms peeling off in strips. I regret I am still alive, while your baby is not. I am sorry, another said earnestly, with lips swollen to the size of oranges, as he spoke to a child weeping beside her dead mother. I am so sorry that I was not taken instead. Though Eastern relationship honoring is admirable and beautiful, so is Western respect for individual freedom, self-expression, and personal destiny. The point is not that one is superior to the other, but that a profound difference in cultural values has a powerful impact on the personality styles favored by each culture. In the West, we subscribe to the extrovert ideal, while in much of Asia, at least before the westernization of the past several decades, silence is golden. These contrasting outlooks affect the things we say when our roommates' dishes pile up in the sink, and the things we don't say in a university classroom. Moreover, they tell us that the extrovert ideal is not as sacrosanct as we may have thought. So if, deep down, you've been thinking that it's only natural for the bold and sociable to dominate the reserved and sensitive, and that the extrovert ideal is innate to humanity, Robert McCrae's personality map suggests a different truth, that each way of being, quiet and talkative, careful and audacious, inhibited and unrestrained, is characteristic of its own mighty civilization. Ironically, some of the people who have the most trouble holding on to this truth are Asian American kids from Cupertino. Once they emerge from adolescence and leave the confines of their hometown, they find a world in which loudness and speaking out are the tickets to popularity and financial success. They come to live with a double consciousness, part Asian and part American, with each side calling the other into question. Mike Way, the high school senior who told me he'd rather study than socialize, is a perfect example of this ambivalence. When we first met, he was a high school senior, still nestled in the Cupertino cocoon. Because we put so much emphasis on education, Mike told me then, referring to Asians in general, socializing is not a big part of ourselves. When I caught up with Mike the following autumn, in his freshman year at Stanford, only a 20-minute drive from Cupertino, but a world away demographically, he seemed unsettled. We met at an outdoor cafe, where we sat next to a co-ed group of athletes erupting regularly in laughter. Mike nodded at the athletes, all of whom were white. Caucasians, he said, seemed to be less afraid of other people thinking that what they said was too loud or too stupid. Mike was frustrated by the superficiality of dining hall conversation and by the bullshitting that often substituted for class participation in freshman seminars. He was spending his free time mostly with other Asians, partly because they had the same level of outgoingness he did. The non-Asians tended to make him feel as if he had to be really hyped up or excited, even though that might not be true to who I am. My dorm has 4 Asians in it out of 50 kids, he told me, so I feel more comfortable around them. There's this one guy called Brian, and he's pretty quiet. I can tell he has that Asian quality where you're kind of shy, and I feel comfortable around him for that reason. I feel like I can be myself around him. I don't have to do something just to look cool, whereas around a big group of people that aren't Asian or are just really loud, I feel like I have to play a role. Mike sounded dismissive of Western communication styles, but he admitted that he sometimes wished he could be noisy and uninhibited himself. They're more comfortable with their own character, he said of his Caucasian classmates. Asians are not uncomfortable with who they are, but are uncomfortable with expressing who they are. In a group, there's always that pressure to be outgoing. When they don't live up to it, you can see it in their faces. Mike told me about a freshman ice-breaking event he'd participated in, a scavenger hunt in San Francisco that was supposed to encourage students to step out of their comfort zones. Mike was the only Asian assigned to a rowdy group, some of whom streaked naked down a San Francisco street and cross-dressed in a local department store during the hunt. One girl went to a Victoria's Secret display and stripped down to her underwear. As Mike recounted these details, I thought he was going to tell me that his group had been over the top, inappropriate. But he wasn't critical of the other students. He was critical of himself. When people do things like that, there's a moment when I feel uncomfortable with it. It shows my own limits. Sometimes I feel like they're better than I am. Mike was getting similar messages from his professors. A few weeks after the orientation event, his freshman advisor, a professor at Stanford's medical school, invited a group of students to her house. Mike hoped to make a good impression, but he couldn't think of anything to say. The other students seemed to have no problem joking around and asking intelligent questions. "Mike, you were so loud today," the professor teased him when finally he said goodbye. "You just blew me away." He left her house feeling bad about himself. "People who don't talk are seen as weak or lacking," he concluded ruefully. To be sure, these feelings were not totally new to Mike. He'd experienced glimmers of them back in high school. Cupertino may have an almost Confucian ethic of quiet, study, and relationship honoring, but it's subject to the mores of the extrovert ideal all the same. At the local shopping center on a weekday afternoon, cocky Asian-American teenage guys with spiky haircuts call out to eye-rolling, wise-cracking girls in spaghetti-strapped tank tops. On a Saturday morning at the library, Some teens study intently in corners, but others congregate at boisterous tables. Few of the Asian American kids I spoke to in Cupertino wanted to identify themselves with the word introvert, even if they effectively described themselves that way. While deeply committed to their parents' values, they seemed to divide the world into traditional Asians versus Asian superstars. The traditionals keep their heads down and get their homework done. The superstars do well academically, but also joke around in class, challenge their teachers, and get themselves noticed. Many students deliberately try to be more outgoing than their parents, Mike told me. They think their parents are too quiet, and they try to overcompensate by being flauntingly outgoing. Some of the parents have started to shift their values, too. Asian parents are starting to see that it doesn't pay to be quiet, so they encourage their kids to take speech and debate, Mike said. Our speech and debate program was the second largest in California to give kids exposure to speaking loudly and convincingly. Still, when I first met Mike in Cupertino, his sense of himself and his values was pretty much intact. He knew that he wasn't one of the Asian superstars. He rated himself a 4 on a popularity scale of 1 to 10, but seemed comfortable in his own skin. I'd rather hang out with people whose personalities are more genuine, he told me then, and that tends to lead me toward more quiet people. It's hard to be gleeful when at the same time I'm trying to be wise. Indeed, Mike was probably lucky to enjoy the Cupertino cocoon for as long as he did. Asian American kids who grow up in more typical American communities often face the issues that Mike confronted as a Stanford freshman much earlier in their lives. One study comparing European American and second-generation Chinese American teens over a 5-year period found that the Chinese Americans were significantly more introverted than their American peers throughout adolescence, and paid the price with their self-esteem. While introverted Chinese American 12-year-olds felt perfectly fine about themselves, presumably because they still measured themselves according to their parents' traditional value systems, by the time they got to be 17 and had been more exposed to America's extrovert ideal, their self-regard had taken a nosedive. For Asian American kids, the cost of failing to fit in is social unease. But as they grow up, they may pay the price with their paychecks. The journalist Nicholas Lehman once interviewed a group of Asian Americans on the subject of meritocracy for his book The Big Test. A sentiment that emerges consistently, he wrote, is that meritocracy ends on graduation day, and that afterward, Asians start to fall behind because they don't have quite the right cultural style for getting ahead. Too passive, not hail fellow well met enough. I met many professionals in Cupertino who were struggling with this issue. A well-heeled housewife confided that all the husbands in her social circle had recently accepted jobs in China and were now commuting between Cupertino and Shanghai, partly because their quiet styles prevented them from advancing locally. The American companies think they can't handle business, she said, because of presentation. In business, you have to put a lot of nonsense together and present it. My husband always just makes his point, and that's the end of it. When you look at big companies, almost none of the top executives are Asians. They hire someone who doesn't know anything about the business, but maybe he can make a good presentation. A software engineer told me how overlooked he felt at work in comparison to other people, especially people from European origin who speak without thinking. In China, he said, if you're quiet, you're seen as being wise. It's completely different here. Here, people like to speak out. Even if they have an idea, not completely mature yet, people still speak out. If I could be better in communication, my work would be much more recognized. Even though my manager appreciates me, he still doesn't know I have done work so wonderful. The engineer then confided that he had sought training in American-style extroversion from a Taiwanese-born communications professor named Preston Nee. At Foothill College, just outside Cupertino, Nee conducts day-long seminars called Communication Success for Foreign-Born Professionals. The class is advertised online through a local group called the Silicon Valley Speak Up Association, whose mission is to help foreign-born professionals to succeed in life through enhancement in soft skills. Speak You Mind, reads the organization's homepage. Together, everyone achieve more at SV Speak Up. Curious about what speaking one's mind looks like from an Asian perspective? I signed up for the class. And, a few Saturday mornings later, found myself sitting at a desk in a starkly modern classroom, the Northern California mountain sun streaming through its plate glass windows. There were about 15 students in all, many from Asian countries, but some from Eastern Europe and South America, too. Professor Ni, a friendly-looking man wearing a Western-style suit, a gold-colored tie with a Chinese drawing of a waterfall, and a shy smile, began the class with an overview of American business culture. In the United States, he warned, you need style as well as substance if you want to get ahead. It may not be fair, and it might not be the best way of judging a person's contribution to the bottom line, but if you don't have charisma, you can be the most brilliant person in the world, and you'll still be disrespected. This is different from many other cultures, said Ni. When a Chinese communist leader makes a speech, he reads it, not even from a teleprompter, but from a paper. If he's the leader, everyone has to listen. Ni asked for volunteers and brought Raj, a 20-something Indian software engineer at a Fortune 500 company, to the front of the room. Raj was dressed in the Silicon Valley uniform of casual button-down shirt and chinos, but his body language was defensive. He stood with his arms crossed protectively over his chest, scuffing at the ground with his hiking boots. Earlier that morning, when we'd gone around the room introducing ourselves, he'd told us, in a tremulous voice from his seat in the back row, that he wanted to learn how to make more conversation and to be more open. Professor Ni asked Raj to tell the class about his plans for the rest of the weekend. I'm going to dinner with a friend, replied Raj, looking fixedly at Ni, his voice barely audible, and then perhaps tomorrow I'll go hiking. Professor Ni asked him to try it again. I'm going to dinner with a friend, said Raj, and then, mumble, 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 I'll go hiking. My impression of you, Professor Ni told Raj gently, is that I can give you a lot of work to do, but I don't have to pay much attention to you. Remember, in Silicon Valley, you can be the smartest, most capable person, but if you can't express yourself aside from showing your work, you'll be underappreciated. Many foreign-born professionals experience this. You're a glorified laborer instead of a leader. The class nodded sympathetically. But there's a way to be yourself, continued Ni, and to let more of you come out through your voice. Many Asians use only a narrow set of muscles when they speak, so we'll start with breathing. With that, he directed Raj to lie on his back and vocalize the five American English vowels. A-E-U-O-I, intoned Raj, his voice floating up from the classroom floor. A-E-U-O-I. A-E-U-O-I. Finally, Professor Ni deemed Raj ready to stand up again. Now, what interesting things do you have planned for after class? He asked, clapping his hands encouragingly. Tonight I'm going to a friend's place for dinner, and tomorrow I'm going hiking with another friend. Raj's voice was louder than before, and the class applauded with gusto. The professor himself is a role model for what can happen when you work at it. After class, I visited him in his office, and he told me how shy he'd been when he first came to the United States, how he put himself in situations like summer camp and business school, where he could practice acting extroverted until it came more naturally. These days, he has a successful consulting practice, with clients that include Yahoo, Chevron, and Microsoft, teaching some of the same skills he labored to acquire himself. But when we began talking about Asian concepts of soft power, what Ni calls leadership by water rather than by fire, I started to see a side of him that was less impressed by Western styles of communication. In Asian cultures, Ni said, there's often a subtle way to get what you want. It's not always aggressive, but it can be very determined and very skillful. In the end, much is achieved because of it. Aggressive power beats you up. Soft power wins you over. I asked the professor for real-life examples of soft power, and his eyes shone as he told me of clients whose strength lay in their ideas and heart. Many of these people were organizers of employee groups, women's groups, diversity groups, who had managed to rally people to their cause through conviction rather than dynamism. He also talked about groups like Mothers Against Drunk Driving, clusters of people who change lives through the power not of their charisma, but of their caring. Their communication skills are sufficient to convey their message, but their real strength comes from substance. In the long run, said Nee, if the idea is good, people shift. If the cause is just, and you put your heart into it, it's almost a universal law. You will attract people who want to share your cause. Soft power is quiet persistence. The people I'm thinking of are very persistent in their day-to-day, person-to-person interactions. Eventually, they build up a team. Soft power, said Nee, was wielded by people we've admired throughout history, Mother Teresa, the Buddha, Gandhi. I was struck when Nee mentioned Gandhi. I had asked almost all the Cupertino High School students I met to name a leader they admired, and many had named Gandhi. What was it about him that inspired them so? Gandhi was, according to his autobiography, a constitutionally shy and quiet man. As a child, he was afraid of everything. Thieves, ghosts, snakes, the dark, and especially other people. He buried himself in books and ran home from school as soon as it was over, for fear of having to talk to anybody. Even as a young man, when he was elected to his first leadership position as a member of the executive committee of the Vegetarian Society, he attended every meeting, but was too shy to speak. "You talk to me quite all right," one of the members asked him, confused. "But why is it you never open your lips at a committee meeting? You are a drone." When a political struggle occurred on the committee, Gandhi had firm opinions, but was too scared to voice them. He wrote his thoughts down, intending to read them aloud at a meeting, but in the end he was too cowed even to do that. Gandhi learned over time to manage his shyness, but he never really overcame it. He couldn't speak extemporaneously. He avoided making speeches whenever possible. Even in his later years, he wrote, "I do not think I could or would even be inclined to keep a meeting of friends engaged in talk." But with his shyness came his unique brand of strength, a form of restraint best understood by examining little-known corners of Gandhi's life story. As a young man, he decided to travel to England to study law, against the wishes of the leaders of his Modi Banya subcaste. Caste members were forbidden to eat meat, and the leaders believed that vegetarianism was impossible in England. But Gandhi had already vowed to his beloved mother to abstain from meat, so he saw no danger in the trip. He said as much to the chef, the head man of the community. "Will you disregard the orders of the caste?" demanded the chef. "I am really helpless," replied Gandhi. "I think the caste should not interfere in the matter." Boom, he was excommunicated, a judgment that remained in force even when he returned from England several years later, with the promise of success that attended a young English-speaking lawyer. The community was divided over how to handle him. One camp embraced him, the other cast him out. This meant that Gandhi was not allowed even to eat or drink at the homes of fellow sub-caste members, including his own sister and his mother and father-in-law. Another man, Gandhi knew, would protest for readmission, but he couldn't see the point. He knew that fighting would only generate retaliation. Instead, he followed the chef's wishes and kept at a distance, even from his own family. His sister and in-laws were prepared to host him at their homes in secret, but he turned them down. The result of this compliance? The subcaste not only stopped bothering him, but its members, including those who had excommunicated him, helped in his later political work, without expecting anything in return. They treated him with affection and generosity. "It is my conviction," Gandhi wrote later, "that all these good things are due to my non-resistance. Had I agitated for being admitted to the caste, had I attempted to divide it into more camps, had I provoked the caste men, they would surely have retaliated, and instead of steering clear of the storm, I should, on arrival from England, have found myself in a whirlpool of agitation." This pattern, the decision to accept what another man would challenge, occurred again and again in Gandhi's life. As a young lawyer in South Africa, he applied for admission to the local bar. The Law Society didn't want Indian members and tried to thwart his application by requiring an original copy of a certificate that was on file in the Bombay High Court and therefore inaccessible. Gandhi was enraged. He knew well that the true reason for these barriers was discrimination. But he didn't let his feelings show. Instead, he negotiated patiently until the Law Society agreed to accept an affidavit from a local dignitary. The day arrived when he stood to take the oath, at which point the Chief Justice ordered him to take off his turban. Gandhi saw his true limitations then. He knew that resistance would be justified, but believed in picking his battles. So he took off his headgear. His friends were upset. They said he was weak, that he should have stood up for his beliefs. But Gandhi felt that he had learned to appreciate the beauty of compromise. If I told you these stories without mentioning Gandhi's name and later achievements, you might view him as a deeply passive man. And in the West, passivity is a transgression. To be passive, according to the Merriam-Webster dictionary, means to be acted upon by an external agency. It also means to be submissive. Gandhi himself ultimately rejected the phrase passive resistance, which he associated with weakness, preferring satyagraha, the term he coined to mean firmness in the pursuit of truth. But as the word satyagraha implies, Gandhi's passivity was not weakness at all. It meant focusing on an ultimate goal and refusing to divert energy to unnecessary skirmishes along the way. Restraint, Gandhi believed, was one of his greatest assets, and it was born of his shyness. "I have naturally formed the habit of restraining my thoughts. A thoughtless word hardly ever escaped my tongue or pen. Experience has taught me that silence is part of the spiritual discipline of a votary of truth." We find so many people impatient to talk. All this talking can hardly be said to be of any benefit to the world. It is so much waste of time. My shyness has been, in reality, my shield and buckler. It has allowed me to grow. It has helped me in my discernment of truth. Soft power is not limited to moral exemplars like Mahatma Gandhi. Consider, for example, the much ballyhooed excellence of Asians in fields like math and science. Professor Nee defines soft power as quiet persistence, and this trait lies at the heart of academic excellence as surely as it does in Gandhi's political triumphs. Quiet persistence requires sustained attention, in effect restraining one's reactions to external stimuli. The TIMSS exam, Trends in International Mathematics and Science Study, is a standardized math and science test given every 4 years to kids around the world. After each test, researchers slice and dice the results, comparing the performance of students from different countries. Asian countries such as Korea, Singapore, Japan, and Taiwan consistently rank at the top of the list. In 1995, for example, the first year the TIMSS was given, Korea, Singapore, and Japan had the world's highest average middle school math scores and were among the top four worldwide in science. In 2007, when researchers measured how many students in a given country reached the advanced international benchmark, a kind of superstar status for math students, they found that most of the standouts were clustered in just a few Asian countries. About 40% of fourth graders in Singapore and Hong Kong reached or surpassed the advanced benchmark, and about 40 to 45% of eighth graders in Taiwan, Korea, and Singapore pulled it off. Worldwide, the median percentage of students reaching the advanced benchmark was only 5% at the fourth grade and 2% at the eighth grade. How to explain these sensational performance gaps between Asia and the rest of the world? Consider this interesting wrinkle in the TIMSS exam. Students taking the test are also asked to answer a tedious series of questions about themselves, ranging from how much they enjoy science to whether there are enough books in their home to fill three or more bookcases. The questionnaire takes a long time to complete, and since it doesn't count toward the final grade, many students leave a lot of questions blank. You'd have to be pretty persistent to answer every single one. But it turns out, according to a study by education professor Erling Boh, that the nations whose students fill out more of the questionnaire also tend to have students who do well on the TIMSS test. In other words, excellent students seem not only to possess the cognitive ability to solve math and science problems, but also to have a useful personality characteristic, quiet persistence. Other studies have also found unusual levels of persistence in even very young Asian children. For example, the cross-cultural psychologist Priscilla Blinko gave Japanese and American first graders an unsolvable puzzle to work on in solitude, without the help of other children or a teacher, and compared how long they tried before giving up. The Japanese children spent an average of 13.93 minutes on the puzzle before calling it quits, whereas the American kids spent only 9.47 minutes. Fewer than 27% of the American students persisted as long as the average Japanese student, and only 10% of the Japanese students gave up as quickly as the average American. Blinko attributes these results to the Japanese quality of persistence. The quiet persistence shown by many Asians and Asian Americans is not limited to the fields of math and science. Several years after my first trip to Cupertino, I caught up with Tiffany Liao, the Swarthmore-bound high school student whose parents had praised her so highly for loving to read, even in public, when she was a young girl. When we first met, Tiffany was a baby-faced 17-year-old on her way to college. She told me then that she was excited to travel to the East Coast and meet new people, but was also afraid of living in a place where no one else would drink bubble tea, the popular drink invented in Taiwan. Now Tiffany was a worldly and sophisticated college senior. She had studied abroad in Spain. She signed her notes with a continental touch. Abrazos, Tiffany. In her Facebook picture, the childlike look was gone, replaced with a smile that was still soft and friendly, but also knowing. Tiffany was on her way to realizing her dream of becoming a journalist, having just been elected editor-in-chief of the college newspaper. She still described herself as shy. She feels a heat rush on her face when she first speaks in public or picks up the phone to call a stranger, but had become more comfortable speaking up. She believed that her quiet traits, as she called them, had helped her become editor-in-chief. For Tiffany, soft power meant listening attentively, taking thorough notes, and doing deep research on her interview subjects before meeting them face-to-face. This process has contributed to my success as a journalist, she wrote to me. Tiffany had come to embrace the power of quiet. When I first met Mike Wei, the Stanford student who wished he was as uninhibited as his classmates, he said there was no such thing as a quiet leader. How can you let people know you have conviction if you're quiet about it? He asked. I reassured him that this wasn't so. But Mike had so much quiet conviction about the inability of quiet people to convey conviction that deep down I'd wondered whether he had a point. But that was before I heard Professor Ni talk about Asian-style soft power, before I read Gandhi on Satyagraha, before I contemplated Tiffany's bright future as a journalist. Conviction is conviction, the kids from Cupertino taught me, at whatever decibel level it's expressed. Part 4. How to Love, How to Work. Chapter 9. When should you act more extroverted than you really are? A man has as many social selves as there are distinct groups of persons about whose opinion he cares. He generally shows a different side of himself to each of these different groups. William James. Meet Professor Brian Little, former Harvard University psychology lecturer and winner of the 3M Teaching Fellowship, sometimes referred to as the Nobel Prize of University Teaching. Short, sturdy, bespectacled, and endearing, Professor Little has a booming baritone, a habit of breaking into song and twirling about on stage, and an old-school actor's way of emphasizing consonants and elongating vowels. He's been described as a cross between Robin Williams and Albert Einstein. And when he makes a joke that pleases his audience, which happens a lot, he looks even more delighted than they do. His classes at Harvard were always oversubscribed and often ended with standing ovations. In contrast, the man I'm about to describe seems a very different breed. He lives with his wife in a tucked-away house on more than 2 acres of remote Canadian woods, visited occasionally by his children and grandchildren, but otherwise keeping to himself. He spends his free time scoring music, reading and writing books and articles, and emailing friends long notes he calls epistles. When he does socialize, he favors one-on-one encounters. At parties, he pairs off into quiet conversations as soon as he can or excuses himself for a breath of fresh air. When he's forced to spend too much time out and about or in any situation involving conflict, he can literally become ill. Would you be surprised if I told you that the vaudevillian professor and the recluse who prefers a life of the mind are one and the same man? Maybe not. When you consider that we all behave differently depending on the situation. But if we're capable of such flexibility, does it even make sense to chart the differences between introverts and extroverts? Is the very notion of introversion, extroversion, too pat a dichotomy? The introvert as sage philosopher, the extrovert as fearless leader, the introvert as poet or science nerd, the extrovert as jock or cheerleader? Aren't we all a little of both? Psychologists call this the person-situation debate. Do fixed personality traits really exist, or do they shift according to the situation in which people find themselves? If you talk to Professor Little, he'll tell you that despite his public persona and his teaching accolades, he's a true blue, off-the-charts introvert. Not only behaviorally, but also neurophysiologically. He took the lemon juice test I described in Chapter 4 and salivated right on cue. This would seem to place him squarely on the person side of the debate. Little believes that personality traits exist, that they shape our lives in profound ways, that they're based on physiological mechanisms, and that they're relatively stable across a lifespan. Those who take this view stand on broad shoulders. Hippocrates, Milton, Schopenhauer, Jung, and more recently the prophets of fMRI machines and skin conductance tests. On the other side of the debate are a group of psychologists known as the situationists. Situationism posits that our generalizations about people, including the words we use to describe one another, shy, aggressive, conscientious, agreeable, are misleading. There is no core self. There are only the various selves of situations X, Y, and Z. The situationist view rose to prominence in 1968 when the psychologist Walter Mischel published Personality and Assessment, challenging the idea of fixed personality traits. Mischel argued that situational factors predict the behavior of people like Brian Little much better than supposed personality traits. For the next few decades, situationism prevailed. The postmodern view of self that emerged around this time, influenced by theorists like Irving Goffman, author of The Presentation of Self in Everyday Life, suggested that social life is performance, and social masks are our true selves. Many researchers doubted whether personality traits even existed in any meaningful sense. Personality researchers had trouble finding jobs. But just as the nature-nurture debate was replaced with interactionism, the insight that both factors contribute to who we are and indeed influence each other, so has the person-situation debate been superseded by a more nuanced understanding. Personality psychologists acknowledge that we can feel sociable at 6 p.m. and solitary at 10 p.m., and that these fluctuations are real and situation-dependent. But they also emphasize how much evidence has emerged to support the premise that notwithstanding these variations, there truly is such a thing as a fixed personality. These days, even Michel admits that personality traits exist, but he believes they tend to occur in patterns. For example, some people are aggressive with peers and subordinates, but docile with authority figures. Others are just the opposite. People who are rejection-sensitive are warm and loving when they feel secure, hostile and controlling when they feel rejected. But this comfortable compromise raises a variation on the problem of free will that we explored in Chapter 5. We know that there are physiological limits on who we are and how we act. But should we attempt to manipulate our behavior within the range available to us? Or should we simply be true to ourselves? At what point does controlling our behavior become futile or exhausting? If you're an introvert in corporate America, should you try to save your true self for quiet weekends and spend your weekdays striving to get out there, mix, speak more often, and connect with your team and others, deploying all the energy and personality you can muster, as Jack Welch advised in a Business Week online column? If you're an extroverted university student, should you save your true self for rowdy weekends and spend your weekdays focusing and studying? Can people fine-tune their own personalities this way? The only good answer I've heard to these questions comes from Professor Brian Little. On the morning of October 12, 1979, Little visited the Royal Military College Saint-Jean on the Richelieu River, 40 kilometers south of Montreal, to address a group of senior military officers. As an introvert might be expected to do, he'd prepared thoroughly for the speech, not only rehearsing his remarks, but also making sure he could cite the latest research. Even while delivering his talk, he was in what he calls classic introvert mode, continually scanning the room for audience displeasure and making adjustments as needed, a statistical reference here, a dollop of humor there. The speech was a success, so much so that he would be invited to make it every year. But the next invitation the college extended horrified him: to join the top brass for lunch. Little had to deliver another lecture that afternoon, and he knew that making small talk for an hour and a half would wipe him out. He needed to recharge for his afternoon performance. Thinking quickly, he announced that he had a passion for ship design and asked his hosts if he might instead take the opportunity of his visit to admire the boats passing by on the Richelieu River. He then spent his lunch hour strolling up and down the river pathway with an appreciative expression on his face. For years, Little returned to lecture at the college, and for years, at lunchtime, he walked the banks of the Richelieu River, indulging his imaginary hobby, until the day the college moved its campus to a landlocked location. Stripped of his cover story, Professor Little resorted to the only escape hatch he could find, the men's room. After each lecture, he would race to the restroom and hide inside a stall. One time, a military man spotted Little's shoes under the door and began a hearty conversation. So Little took to keeping his feet propped up on the bathroom walls, where they would be hidden from view. Taking shelter in bathrooms is a surprisingly common phenomenon, as you probably know if you're an introvert. "After a talk, I'm in bathroom stall number 9," Little once told Peter Gazowski, one of Canada's most eminent talk show hosts. "After a show, I'm in stall number 8, replied Gazowski, not missing a beat. You might wonder how a strong introvert like Professor Little manages to speak in public so effectively. The answer, he says, is simple, and it has to do with a new field of psychology that he created almost single-handedly, called free trait theory. Little believes that fixed traits and free traits coexist. According to free trait theory, we are born and culturally endowed with certain personality traits, introversion, for example, but we can and do act out of character in the service of core personal projects. In other words, introverts are capable of acting like extroverts for the sake of work they consider important, people they love, or anything they value highly. Free trait theory explains why an introvert might throw his extroverted wife a surprise party or join the PTA at his daughter's school. It explains how it's possible for an extroverted scientist to behave with reserve in her laboratory, for an agreeable person to act hard-nosed during a business negotiation, and for a cantankerous uncle to treat his niece tenderly when he takes her out for ice cream. As these examples suggest, free trait theory applies in many different contexts, but it's especially relevant for introverts living under the extrovert ideal. According to Little, our lives are dramatically enhanced when we're involved in core personal projects that we consider meaningful, manageable, and not unduly stressful, and that are supported by others. When someone asks us, "How are things?" we may give a throwaway answer, but our true response is a function of how well our core personal projects are going. That's why Professor Little, the consummate introvert, lectures with such passion. Like a modern-day Socrates, he loves his students deeply. Opening their minds and attending to their well-being are two of his core personal projects. When Little held office hours at Harvard, the students lined up in the hallway as if he were giving out free tickets to a rock concert. For more than 20 years, his students asked him to write several hundred letters of recommendation a year. Brian Little is the most engaging, entertaining, and caring professor I have ever encountered, wrote one student about him. I cannot even begin to explain the myriad ways in which he has positively affected my life. So, for Brian Little, the additional effort required to stretch his natural boundaries is justified by seeing his core personal project, igniting all those minds, come to fruition. At first blush, free trait theory seems to run counter to a cherished piece of our cultural heritage. Shakespeare's oft-quoted advice, "To thine own self be true," runs deep in our philosophical DNA. Many of us are uncomfortable with the idea of taking on a false persona for any length of time. And if we act out of character by convincing ourselves that our pseudo-self is real, we can eventually burn out without even knowing why. The genius of Little's theory is how neatly it resolves this discomfort. Yes, we are only pretending to be extroverts. And yes, such inauthenticity can be morally ambiguous, not to mention exhausting. But if it's in the service of love or a professional calling, then we're doing just as Shakespeare advised. When people are skilled at adopting free traits, it can be hard to believe that they're acting out of character. Professor Little's students are usually incredulous when he claims to be an introvert. But Little is far from unique. Many people, especially those in leadership roles, engage in a certain level of pretend extroversion. Consider, for example, my friend Alex, the socially adept head of a financial services company, who agreed to give a candid interview on the condition of sealed-in-blood anonymity. Alex told me that pretend extroversion was something he taught himself in the 7th grade, when he decided that other kids were taking advantage of him. "I was the nicest person you'd ever want to know," Alex recalls, "but the world wasn't that way. The problem was that if you were just a nice person, you'd get crushed. I refused to live a life where people could do that stuff to me. I was like, okay, what's the policy prescription here? And there really was only one. I needed to have every person in my pocket. If I wanted to be a nice person, I needed to run the school. But how to get from A to B? I studied social dynamics. I guarantee more than anyone you've ever met," Alex told me. He observed the way people talked, the way they walked, especially male dominance poses. He adjusted his own persona, which allowed him to go on being a fundamentally shy, sweet kid, but without being taken advantage of. "Any hard thing where you can get crushed, I was like, I need to learn how to do this. So by now, I'm built for war, because then people don't screw you. Alex also took advantage of his natural strengths. I learned that boys basically do only one thing. They chase girls. They get them, they lose them, they talk about them. I was like, that's completely circuitous. I really like girls. That's where intimacy comes from. So rather than sitting around and talking about girls, I got to know them. I used having relationships with girls, plus being good at sports, to have the guys in my pocket. Oh, and every once in a while, you have to punch people. I did that, too. Today, Alex has a folksy, affable, whistle-while-you-work demeanor. I've never seen him in a bad mood. But you'll see his self-taught, bellicose side if you ever try to cross him in a negotiation, and you'll see his introverted self if you ever try to make dinner plans with him. I could literally go years without having any friends except for my wife and kids, he says. Look at you and me. You're one of my best friends. And how many times do we actually talk? When you call me. I don't like socializing. My dream is to live off the land on 1,000 acres with my family. You never see a team of friends in that dream. So notwithstanding whatever you might see in my public persona, I am an introvert. I think that fundamentally, I'm the same person I always was. Massively shy. But I compensate for it. But how many of us are really capable of acting out of character to this degree, putting aside for the moment the question of whether we want to? Professor Little happens to be a great performer, and so are many CEOs. What about the rest of us? Some years ago, a research psychologist named Richard Lippa set out to answer this question. He called a group of introverts to his lab and asked them to act like extroverts while pretending to teach a math class. Then he and his team, video cameras in hand, measured the length of their strides, the amount of eye contact they made with their students, the percentage of time they spent talking, the pace and volume of their speech, and the total length of each teaching session. They also rated how generally extroverted the subjects appeared, based on their recorded voices and body language. Then Lippa did the same thing with actual extroverts and compared the results. He found that although the latter group came across as more extroverted, some of the pseudo-extroverts were surprisingly convincing. It seems that most of us know how to fake it to some extent. Whether or not we're aware that the length of our strides and the amount of time we spend talking and smiling mark us as introverts and extroverts, we know it unconsciously. Still, there's a limit to how much we can control our self-presentation. This is partly because of a phenomenon called behavioral leakage, in which our true selves seep out via unconscious body language. A subtle look away at a moment when an extrovert would have made eye contact, or a skillful turn of the conversation by a lecturer that places the burden of talking on the audience when an extroverted speaker would have held the floor a little longer. How was it that some of Lippa's pseudo-extroverts came so close to the scores of true extroverts? It turned out that the introverts who were especially good at acting like extroverts tended to score high for a trait that psychologists call self-monitoring. Self-monitors are highly skilled at modifying their behavior to the social demands of a situation. They look for cues to tell them how to act. When in Rome, they do as the Romans do, according to the psychologist Mark Snyder, author of Public Appearances, Private Realities, and creator of the self-monitoring scale. One of the most effective self-monitors I've ever met is a man named Edgar, a well-known and much-beloved fixture on the New York social circuit. He and his wife host or attend fundraisers and other social events seemingly every weeknight. He's the kind of enfant terrible whose latest antics are a favorite topic of conversation. But Edgar is an avowed introvert. I'd much rather sit and read and think about things than talk to people, he says. Yet talk to people he does. Edgar was raised in a highly social family that expected him to self-monitor, and he's motivated to do so. I love politics, he says. I love policy. I love making things happen. I want to change the world in my own way. So I do stuff that's artificial. I don't really like being the guest at someone else's party, because then I have to be entertaining. But I'll host parties, because it puts you at the center of things without actually being a social person. When he does find himself at other people's parties, Edgar goes to great lengths to play his role. All through college, and recently even, before I ever went to a dinner or cocktail party, I would have an index card with 3 to 5 relevant, amusing anecdotes. I'd come up with them during the day. If something struck me, I'd jot it down. Then, at dinner, I'd wait for the right opening and launch in. Sometimes I'd have to go to the bathroom and pull out my cards to remember what my little stories were. Over time, though, Edgar stopped bringing index cards to dinner parties. He still considers himself an introvert, but he grew so deeply into his extroverted role that telling anecdotes started to come naturally to him. Indeed, the highest self-monitors tend not only to be good at producing the desired effect and emotion in a given social situation, they also experience less stress while doing so. In contrast to the Edgars of the world, low self-monitors base their behavior on their own internal compass. They have a smaller repertoire of social behaviors and masks at their disposal. They're less sensitive to situational cues, like how many anecdotes you're expected to share at a dinner party, and less interested in role-playing, even when they know what the cues are. It's as if low self-monitors, LSMs, and high self-monitors, HSMs, play to different audiences, Snyder has said, one inner, the other outer. If you want to know how strong a self-monitor you are, here are a few questions from Snyder's self-monitoring scale. When you're uncertain how to act in a social situation, do you look to the behavior of others for cues? Do you often seek the advice of your friends to choose movies, books, or music? In different situations and with different people, do you often act like very different people? Do you find it easy to imitate other people? Can you look someone in the eye and tell a lie with a straight face, if for a right end? Do you ever deceive people by being friendly when really you dislike them? Do you put on a show to impress or entertain people? Do you sometimes appear to others to be experiencing deeper emotions than you actually are? The more times you answered yes to these questions, the more of a high self-monitor you are. Now ask yourself these questions. Is your behavior usually an expression of your true inner feelings, attitudes, and beliefs? Do you find that you can only argue for ideas that you already believe? Would you refuse to change your opinions or the way you do things in order to please someone else or win their favor? Do you dislike games like charades or improvisational acting? Do you have trouble changing your behavior to suit different people and different situations? The more you tended to answer yes to this second set of questions, the more of a low self-monitor you are. When Professor Little introduced the concept of self-monitoring to his personality psychology classes, some students got very worked up about whether it was ethical to be a high self-monitor. A few mixed couples, HSMs and LSMs in love, even broke up over it, he was told. To high self-monitors, low self-monitors can seem rigid and socially awkward. To low self-monitors, high self-monitors can come across as conformist and deceptive, more pragmatic than principled, in Mark Snyder's words. Indeed, HSMs have been found to be better liars than LSMs, which would seem to support the moralistic stance taken by low self-monitors. But Little, an ethical and sympathetic man who happens to be an extremely high self-monitor, sees things differently. He views self-monitoring as an act of modesty. It's about accommodating oneself to situational norms rather than grinding down everything to one's own needs and concerns. Not all self-monitoring is based on acting, he says, or on working the room. A more introverted version may be less concerned with spotlight seeking and more with the avoidance of social faux pas. When Professor Little makes a great speech, it's partly because he's self-monitoring every moment, continually checking his audience for subtle signs of pleasure or boredom and adjusting his presentation to meet its needs. So if you can fake it, if you master the acting skills, the attention to social nuance, and the willingness to submit to social norms that self-monitoring requires, should you? The answer is that a free trait strategy can be effective when used judiciously, but disastrous if overdone. Recently, I spoke on a panel at Harvard Law School. The occasion was the 55th anniversary of women being admitted to the law school. Alumni from all over the country gathered on campus to celebrate. The subject of the panel was, In a Different Voice, Strategies for Powerful Self-Presentation. There were four speakers, a trial lawyer, a judge, a public speaking coach, and me. I'd prepared my remarks carefully. I knew the role I wanted to play. The public speaking coach went first. She talked about how to give a talk that knocks people's socks off. The judge, who happened to be Korean-American, spoke of how frustrating it is when people assume that all Asians are quiet and studious, when in fact she's outgoing and assertive. The litigator, who was petite and blonde and feisty as hell, talked about the time she conducted a cross-examination only to be admonished by a judge to back down, tiger. When my turn came, I aimed my remarks at the women in the audience who didn't see themselves as tigers, mythbusters, or sock knocker offers. I said that the ability to negotiate is not inborn, like blonde hair or straight teeth, and it does not belong exclusively to the table pounders of the world. Anyone can be a great negotiator, I told them, and in fact, it often pays to be quiet and gracious, to listen more than talk, and to have an instinct for harmony rather than conflict. With this style, you can take aggressive positions without inflaming your counterpart's ego. And by listening, you can learn what's truly motivating the person you're negotiating with and come up with creative solutions that satisfy both parties. I also shared some psychological tricks for feeling calm and secure during intimidating situations, such as paying attention to how your face and body arrange themselves when you're feeling genuinely confident and adopting those same positions when it comes time to fake it. Studies show that taking simple physical steps, like smiling, makes us feel stronger and happier, while frowning makes us feel worse. Naturally, when the panel was over and the audience members came around to chat with the panelists, it was the introverts and pseudo-extroverts who sought me out. Two of those women stand out in my mind. The first was Allison, a trial lawyer. Allison was slim and meticulously groomed, but her face was pale, pinched, and unhappy-looking. She'd been a litigator at the same corporate law firm for over a decade. Now she was applying for general counsel positions at various companies, which seemed a logical next step, except that her heart clearly wasn't in it. And sure enough, she hadn't gotten a single job offer. On the strength of her credentials, she was advancing to the final round of interviews, only to be weeded out at the last minute. And she knew why. Because the headhunter who'd coordinated her interviews gave the same feedback each time. She lacked the right personality for the job. Allison, a self-described introvert, looked pained as she relayed this damning judgment. The second alumna, Jillian, held a senior position at an environmental advocacy organization that she loved. Jillian came across as kind, cheerful, and down-to-earth. She was fortunate to spend much of her time researching and writing policy papers on topics she cared about. Sometimes, though, she had to chair meetings and make presentations. Although she felt deep satisfaction after these meetings, she didn't enjoy the spotlight and wanted my advice on staying cool when she felt scared. So what was the difference between Allison and Jillian? Both were pseudo-extroverts, and you might say that Allison was trying and failing where Jillian was succeeding. But Allison's problem was actually that she was acting out of character in the service of a project she didn't care about. She didn't love the law. She'd chosen to become a Wall Street litigator because it seemed to her that this was what powerful and successful lawyers did. So her pseudo-extroversion was not supported by deeper values. She was not telling herself, I'm doing this to advance work I care about deeply, and when the work is done, I'll settle back into my true self. Instead, her interior monologue was, "The route to success is to be the sort of person I am not." This is not self-monitoring. It is self-negation. Where Jillian acts out of character for the sake of worthy tasks that temporarily require a different orientation, Allison believes that there is something fundamentally wrong with who she is. It's not always so easy, it turns out, to identify your core personal projects. And it can be especially tough for introverts who have spent so much of their lives conforming to extroverted norms that by the time they choose a career or a calling, it feels perfectly normal to ignore their own preferences. They may be uncomfortable in law school or nursing school or in the marketing department, but no more so than they were back in middle school or summer camp. I, too, was once in this position. I enjoyed practicing corporate law, and for a while I convinced myself that I was an attorney at heart. I badly wanted to believe it, since I had already invested years in law school and on-the-job training, and much about Wall Street law was alluring. My colleagues were intellectual, kind, and considerate, mostly. I made a good living. I had an office on the 42nd floor of a skyscraper with views of the Statue of Liberty. I enjoyed the idea that I could flourish in such a high-powered environment. And I was pretty good at asking the "but" and "what if" questions that are central to the thought processes of most lawyers. It took me almost a decade to understand that the law was never my personal project, not even close. Today I can tell you unhesitatingly what is. My husband and sons, writing, promoting the values of this book. Once I realized this, I had to make a change. I look back on my years as a Wall Street lawyer as time spent in a foreign country. It was absorbing, it was exciting, and I got to meet a lot of interesting people whom I never would have known otherwise. But I was always an expatriate. Having spent so much time navigating my own career transition and counseling others through theirs, I have found that there are three key steps to identifying your own core personal projects. First, think back to what you loved to do when you were a child. How did you answer the question of what you wanted to be when you grew up? The specific answer you gave may have been off the mark, but the underlying impulse was not. If you wanted to be a fireman, what did a fireman mean to you? A good man who rescued people in distress? A daredevil? Or the simple pleasure of operating a truck? If you wanted to be a dancer, was it because you got to wear a costume, or because you craved applause? Or was it the pure joy of twirling around at lightning speed? You may have known more about who you were then than you do now. Second, pay attention to the work you gravitate to. At my law firm, I never once volunteered to take on an extra corporate legal assignment, but I did spend a lot of time doing pro bono work for a nonprofit women's leadership organization. I also sat on several law firm committees dedicated to mentoring, training, and personal development for young lawyers in the firm. Now, as you can probably tell from this book, I am not the committee type. But the goals of those committees lit me up, so that's what I did. Finally, pay attention to what you envy. Jealousy is an ugly emotion, but it tells the truth. You mostly envy those who have what you desire. I met my own envy after some of my former law school classmates got together and compared notes on alumni career tracks. They spoke with admiration, and yes, jealousy, of a classmate who argued regularly before the Supreme Court. At first I felt critical. More power to that classmate, I thought, congratulating myself on my magnanimity. Then I realized that my largesse came cheap, because I didn't aspire to argue a case before the Supreme Court or to any of the other accolades of lawyering. When I asked myself whom I did envy, the answer came back instantly. My college classmates who'd grown up to be writers or psychologists. Today I'm pursuing my own version of both those roles.